accession number 11970, Reel 10.
Mr. Birdwhistle, Reel 10.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about your time in the hospital and how you were helping out in Birmingham in late 18, well, towards the end of the war.
That's right.
What else do you remember about your time there?
Well, not much. You know, I took one of the nurses to the pictures one night and all. And we're coming in late. She says, oh, you better... Because the fire escape door again, my ward again, back where I was going, the ward, and she said, "You better take the fire escape key down with you, and go in through the fire escape, and then you won't know what to do." And all that, I took her to these pictures, and then I went in my right through the fire escape, and anyway, I weren't long after that when I were back to and they sent me to Manchester to Eaton Park convalescent. Eaton Park, and had nothing to do. I know I was lying about, and I was getting fat because I put it on the 11.7, and I went up to 12.4 there, to 12 pound, 12 stone 4. I know I was going escorts. I went to Burnley on escort with two escort. Anyway, I went to Burnley on escort for these. There were four chaps. Four I had to bring out. And I had four prisoners, but one of them were about 6 foot two. And he come from Crawshay Booth as well. A fella called Pickup, I remember him. And, so I went to Burnley. When I got there, it was morning, and I went in the police station and left my prisoners at the door, and said to the inspector about these four prisoners.
What have they done?
Well, I don't know, absent off leave, I think, more or less, you know. I think that were more or less what that were all they were right in for. They'd been absent off leave, I think. Anyway, I said to this inspector there, I said, I've come for four prisoners. I said, and my lads are outside. And I said, he said, what time do you train? So I said, oh, it's 10 minutes past two, you know. He says, oh, well, he says, come back again. He said, we can't let you have prisoners till, like, up and down, till so and so. He told me to come back at such a time. So I said, right, okay. So I went out and I told these prisoners, and it was getting toward dinner time. And I said, I'm going up to my Uncle Billy's. I said, for my lunch. I said, so here, I said, now there's 10 bob here, and of course 10 bob in them days, you know, and you could get anything for 10 shillings. I said, you better get some dinner like. So I said, I'll meet you at the centre. I said, centre Burnley, that was just outside the palace. I said, so I could get these prisoners out anyway for two, somewhere about. Because it only takes a quarter of an hour to get up to Bangkok Station, about half past one or something like that. And so I went up to my Uncle Billy's, and I stopped till, of course, more or less on time. And when I'm going down to the centre of the town, there's a right gang in the middle of town, a crowd in the centre of the town, and I could see this pickup this pickup, this escort, as were with me, and I'd left them the handcuffs, you see, a pair of handcuffs apiece.
So the prisoners were still in the police station. This was your escort?
No. That's right, yes.
Was
the escort. Yes, that's right. I'd given the money to him and told him to go and get some of it. And I'd left him with the handcuffs, you know. And, I could see this pickup in the middle of this crowd. So what the devil's up here, you know? So, be Joe, when I went in, they'd been up to the Dog and Duck, and they got drunk, and they got four women, and they were drunk, and, well, three sheets in the wind, and they had a man cuffed. Oh, you know, anyway, the policeman there with them, you know. And I said, what's up like? So he said, are you in charge of these? I said, yes, I'm in charge. And he said, well, you'll have the key for these handcuffs, will you? He said, just take the handcuffs off these women. So, of course, I took these handcuffs off these women, you know. I said, right, I'll take my escort now, and I've got to go and go to the police station now with these fellas and get some escort, you know, these prisoners out. So anyway, I left out. As I was going inside the prison yard, there's another officer there, a policeman, and I said, is the chief in? He said, no, the chief's not in. He said, but the sergeant's in. I said, well, I said, I've got these prisoners. They better not see my escort, or else, you know. So he said, I'll tell you what to do. He said, now follow me down here. He said, and tell them all to keep close up to you. He said, when I open this door, he says, you get it back of him. He said, get behind him before I open this door. He said, when I open this door, he says, push the bloody lot in. So he opens this door, and I shove these four in, you know. And he shut the door. He said, that'll sober the buggers up. He said, there's two there on the slabs. He said, mistaked, dark naked. An old cabbie had fallen off his trap or something, anyway, falling off onto the road, and they took him in there, and he had a beard and everything, he told me, and said, you want to sign, and this other fella were in. So anyway, he said, that'll sober up. He said, now, go and get your prisoners. He said, I'll let these out when you come out, you know. So, of course, I went in and saw the sergeant, so he said, where's your escort? I said, they're in the yard. I said, they're waiting out there. So he said, all right, come on. So anyway, I got out and got these prisoners, all right. Well, when I'm coming outside the gate of the prison yard, there's a little woman there, and I'd got the prisoners there, and they had never handcuffed them, you know. And she says, oh, she says, Sergeant, would you let my husband come home? She says, all the family is down with somewhat, you know, and the kiddies were bad, you know. And so anyway, she begged me that much. You know, a little fella called Robinson, I always remember his name. And I said, I can't, I have got four prisoners here, not three, you know. I said, not one. I said, I have four prisoners here. And so anyway, finishing up, I said, right, I said, nothing, I said, there's a four of you, I'm talking to you straight. I said, I'm going to let you go home. I said, but I want you to be at Bank, because I'd asked about the trains from Banktop Station, it was 7 o'clock at night. So I said, now I'll let you go home. I said, and don't forget, you've got to be at Banktop Station to catch that train from Manchester with us. You know, I said, I'll take the escort. Well, they off went, all the four of them. I said, no, they promised. One of them was a farmer's lad. And then there's this little Robinson and his family. He said, the family were bad. And the other two were on. I forget the name now. Anyway, when they'd gone, I went to, because I had a pal in the market, in Burnley Market, and he had a cafe. And it was a built-in place, you know. Well, he was closing it for the afternoon. And so I said to him, I said, hey, I said, can these fellas have a sleep on these seats, you know? I said, while you were away, like. He said, go on, Bert, get them down, you know. So, of course, I bedded these four down on these seats. They slept this one of it off. So I got up. Well, I got some tea. We had some tea there before we went up to what was the pub called? Just outside the station, up at the bank top. A reindeer hotel. Anyway, we went in there, you know. And so I'm going in this room, and there's an old chap sat there in the corner with a beard. And we all went in, and he said, "Landlord," shouted across, he says, "them lads' drinks are on me." So, of course, we got some free beer. we've been drinking, well, first pint, I think, or second pint or something. Anyway, there's a piano in the corner. And I says, "Can any of you play?" And with the same, the niece of the landlord came in with these drinks, you see. Put them on the table. She said, "Yes, I can play." So I said, "Well, if you play, I'll sing, you know." So we're playing, I'm singing, and I'm right, was it. Well, they were getting the drinks in, you know, all on this old chap, this old fella in the corner, was drink. He was the one that sent it drinks over. And
so the escort were getting drunk again?
They're getting drunk again. Escort, aye. And in charge, me in charge as well. Anyway, we went up the station. And there's three of them comes, because we left about a quarter of an hour.
The prisoners?
The three prisoners are there, and we were there with the escort, like. And there's just one, and it's the farmer's lad that's missing. Well, I'm stood at the gate, you know, looking for this farmer's lad, and I said to the guy, to the chap on the, name it's on the... porter on the platform. I said, "Just hold that train up. If he comes, will you just for a minute or two see if this fella comes?" Well, the train's coming in, and blinking, you know. So anyway, I said, "Just hang on to it." I said, "As long as you can." And who shall be coming up the blinking road but the farmer and his son, and a box of blinking bottles between them. Oh, God, we put the. I said, "Get on this blinking train, for God's sake." Well, of course, we were supping these bottles, going to Manchester, you know. Well, we were a three-seat ship, blinking wind. Anyway, I got a taxi when I was got at O'Doohan's. It was not a taxi. Oi, oi. And a little blinking bus or something. I don't know what it were now. Anyway, we all got in, you know, in this van. I think we were a van or something. And took us up to Heaton Park. And the sergeant on duty at the blinking, the guard room, he said, "You're right, blinking shower, aren't you?" He says, "Get in there." And he shoved them all in one cell. And he said, "You better bed down in that one too there." He said, "In that other cell." So I was in one cell and they were in the others.
Anyway,
in the doing, but anyway, next morning we're all right, you know, because they weren't booked or anything.
That happened after the end of the war, or before the end of the war?
Well, it was just, it was during the armistice, wasn't it? Because it's Christmas, just before Christmas time, you know.
Just going back a bit then, I believe there's a story about how you heard about the armistice.
Oh, yeah, that was when I was, I went on leave from Manchester, weekend leave, you know.
Tell me about how you first
heard
them.
I went down to Rawtenstall during, I think I got a week off. And I went down to Rawtenstall and went in the barber's shop. And I'm going for a shave, you know. And he's lathered me, and they were just shaving me, you know. When the door opened, and this fellow says, Armistice is signed. Oh, blimey. Well, the barber's hand, you know, I said, "Hey, get off me." I jumped out of the chair. I wiped my face on the towel and I threw at him. I said, "Here." And I off out to a drinking shop and all. He's got me blinking throat if I'm not careful, you know. So anyway, A day or two after, I remember that, and paid him, you know, so I went in and paid him, and got to finish shaving. Oh, that was the day.
Did you join in any celebrations that day?
No, I never joined in any celebrations at all. I kept away from everything because, I don't know.
Why was that?
I don't know, I couldn't tell you why. And then I wrote to the wife's mother. Well, she weren't my wife then, but I wrote to her and asked her if I could go down for a week at Christmas, you know. And so she said, yes, come down by all means. Because I said to my pal, you know, when I met her that day, I said, that's my wife, as soon as I saw her. That were when she came up, that when I was only 16 year old then, you know, and she came in and I said, that's my wife. And anyway, and I were, you know, she were 2 years older than me, and I were, you know, and I thought, well, I used to think 2 years older, you know, and 2 years younger, you know, that's 4 years. Well, they were a lifetime in 60, when you were 16, weren't it? 4 years. And I thought, blimey, if I ask her to go out with me, you know, she'll say, get your nappies off or something, you know, what I used to say. And so I never said nothing to her at all. As a matter of fact, I went out with her sister once or twice, you know, her younger sister. And then this were in France, I wrote to her from France. And then I went down at Christmas. And of course, then I were a full-grown chap then, like, you know. so I dared to ask her, like, would you go out with me, you know. So I took her to the pictures and all the week. I were taking her out every day, going down. Well, as a matter of fact, I went to the house where she were working, and who should come to the door but the lady she were working for, you know, because they had a, her and her husband, they had a, are you right? Yes, well, I know I went down one day when to where she were working, and the lady of the house came. And she said, oh, are you Vera's boyfriend? I said, I'm hoping so, you know. And she said, well, you better come inside. And when we went in, she said, shouts upstairs, she said, Vera, your boyfriend here, you better get dressed and get out, you know, off. So, of course, that was the, well, yeah, I could go down every day and see her, you know. And here's taking a picture and all the other. Anyway, instead of having a week, I stopped a fortnight. I was going to go a week home, you know, go down there for a week, and then go home for a week. But anyway, I spent the fortnight down there, so of course I was at the wrong side of the parents when I got home, you know. What do you want to stop in there for a fortnight for? Anyway, I told them, and she came up here for a holiday. And some time after, anyway. So I took her one day up to see my dad's old Aunt Betty. And there were two sisters of them, but they were right... straight lace, you know, these real Lancashire women they were, and I'm sure they were brought up Quakers, I think, you know. But I said to my Aunt Betty, I said, well, it's 9 o'clock now, Aunt Betty. I said, I know you go to bed about 9 o'clock, like, you know, when the night had gone. And I said, we'll go down Crawshay Booth. Who said that? Look, if any aunt found this time at night. Well, that's Lancashire, that's right, Lancashire, you know. You're not going down Crawshay Booth this time of the night, you know. I said, dear me, it's only young yet, 9 o'clock, you know. So anyway, I went out with her. But I made a poetry up about my Aunt Betty, you know, my dad's old Aunt Betty, about her being so straight-laced. I don't know, there's just a couple of verses here up for you.
All right.
My dad's old Aunt Betty, a tough one who were, and straight as Robin O'Darrer. I remember one day when I called her away, who blooming he'd chill me to marrow. Her rasp of a voice, her aim were like steel, but under all that I knew very well. Her heart were as big as her body, and as soft as a great lump of putty. I remember when Coy were mother and dad, this were of course when I were a lad, who made some mate pies fit for a king, and all folks about him her praises did sing. But no pie for me, I had a tram stopper, he by going over a whopper. You were sponge, all spongy, were covered with coconut ice. Turned up, they comes away, shall I nice? who'd sit there rocking it, out rocking cheer, and woe with a lot of the counter off gear, who make pot of tea and said, just want a sup. He'd have said, I don't mind, I'd get another cup, who put pot, tea pot back upon fireplace hob, and say, I don't mind neither, that's a good job. For I'm sure he were born a Quaker, and who'd call me a fool and a Laker. That's just a bit of a... there's several verses. It was £6,000 when he left, when he finished the work and ran out of weapons and all that, you know. I've forgotten them now.
So
anyway, and then I went to work one morning, and contractor said to me, he said, they better not go back, Albert, today. He said, they better... go up to the graveyard and dig Betty's grave, who'll be tittled to pink to thee for a slave, you know, that was when she died. So I put, we put off tools at Barra, we, Freddie and me, and we lived at Barra, and there it all lay. Went up to the graveyard and found Betty's ground, where how Betty were buried, and we were rest, there for the rest of the band. I forgot now.
So you were at Heaton Park Convalescent Camp until you were demobbed.
Until I was demobbed, yes.
And you were demobbed on the 15th of
February. On the 15th of February 1919, that same day as I joined up.
And what did you plan to do? I mean...
Well, I went back to... What is it? I was in Preshner. I was a...
back to Sunnyside?
That's right, Sunnyside Works.
Could you get back in easily?
Oh, yes. I went back to my own job, you know.
They had kept it for you.
They've been kept for me, yeah. Oh, I was an impressioner thing, impressioner to the Engraving Society, engraving.
Do you think the war had affected you, either mentally or physically, a lot? How did you feel?
Well, I don't know. I think it sent me crackers a bit, you know, because, you know, you've been that used to what it is, I suppose, that one day, I remember... the gaffer come to me, and I don't know, he said something to me, and I don't know what it were, but it just got right on top of me, you know. And I had a doings that I used to take my colours off the, scrape my colours off the rollers with, and it was just like a razor, you know, the edge of it being sharp, you know, and to clean the colour so that it left all the colour into the engraving part. And I said... You know, I grabbed all of him, blinking lapel of his coat, and I'll split you from top to bottom. Stupid of me, you know. Anyway, he never bothered anything about it. I think he thought that, you know, he was a crackpot come back from the war, I think, you know. No, I don't think, because, I mean, to say I calmed down after a while, but you're a little bit gallus, I think, when you come back, you know, from being in the army. I think...
What about your health? Did that? I mean, you've said about you'd always had trouble.
Well, yeah.
Did you have any other problems?
No problems at all. Never had any problems. Only that a touch of rheumatism or different things. You know, that's all.
You loved soldiering. You know, I mean.
A what?
You loved soldiering.
I did.
So much
I
fighting, but the
yeah,
soldiering.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Were you tempted to join the regular army or the territorials?
Well, I once. No, I didn't want to try. I didn't. Territorial, no. They sent me for me twice.
Why weren't you interested?
I don't know. Well, I'd started breeding poultry and I were winning prizes, you see. You know, and I were more interested in that than what I were in the army then. I'd got out of it, you know. I think I'd had enough discipline, you know. I were tired there. And
so you had been keen, but by
now... Oh, I was keen, but I'd lost it then.
It had worn out.
Yes. Because I went to Burnley to the first reunion they had at Burnley.
What, of the 42nd or of the
No, the East Lancashire, you know, the Burnley Battalion. And they sent for me, you know, they sent letters to everybody, you know. And then... I was late, and I was going up a road, and they were coming down, you know, and I was waiting for my company to come down, and as soon as I went across, I walked across to what it, because this company sergeant major, quartermaster sergeant, Ross, he had been totally blind, he was shot through the nose, totally blind, and he were on parade, and they were all of his arms, you know. And as soon as he heard my voice, he left loose of this fellow's arm. He said, come here, Bert. He says, you know, so he just said, give us hold of the arm. And I was walking down with him, you know, he says, oh, he said to me, he says, there's one book of your own prayer, he says, with eye metal.
Right, now you've decided you want to read to us a written piece about your feelings about Passchendaele, 1917.
Right, you are. You're right now then.
Righto.
Okay, right. The Third Battle of Passchendaele, the bloody stark truth. A wilderness of desolation, death. What a scene for a boy of 18 years. Nothing living. Even what is left of the trees are mere splintered stumps, like skeletons of the past. Could this be the future for youth? The only things around in the ground are shell holes, pockmarks filled with stinking slime, dead bodies floating on the surface, blown up like balloons, the sheer ugliness of it all. My thoughts wandered on to my youth. Yes, I now felt an old man had crept up on me and taken the place of the boy who came into this infernal hell only a few days before. This stupendous expanse of nothing but destruction, ploughed by the millions of shells that have exploded and vomited and spewed their volumes of death to destroy the wonderful world of God and the wonderful pieces of manhood. How could man, the mere man, be the one to overrule the supreme creator, to desecrate this wonderful world? Why was God allowing these puppets to tear apart the beauty of his creation? This was the result of man's creation. Could one compare them? No. This was the fiendish lust, that greed of man's insanity. This was the knowledge that we had paid for in our universities, what men call science, the expansion of knowledge to exploit the destruction of one's self. And the things that had taken centuries to build. Man must be mad to allow a few dictators to order the destruction of all this beauty and the youth and manhood for self-gain. But how to stop it now that the minions had got their underdogs to march in this way? Just now it is quiet, so quiet that to breathe, even the intake of breath is disquieting and makes one afraid that the rebound will start up at once again the hell that one has seen so often. But they're underneath in the dirty, squelchy, slippery, slimy, slurry mud that is caked on everything. Nothing has escaped it, and men's faces are the same colour. All look that they are of another race, or just waiting to die of that devouring disease, consumption. Just a little while ago, one could not hear anything but the roar of guns, the blasting of shells exploding every kind of hell that the human brain could invent, the screeching, whining, roaring, the havoc of damnable destruction. What will it be? What will be the end? Will the next one be for me? In what shape or form will it come? Shall I lose an arm, a leg, or both, or be blinded so that I cannot see where I wander? will it be the eternal wilderness of sightlessness, like so many have gone before? If ever there was a Dante's Inferno, this is it. The feeling of utter helplessness to stand here, for to be blown to hell by the doings of which I am purely innocent. But we must continue the struggle for not counting the cost, for this is for humanity and God's world. Whatever it takes, we must save our Creator's world for generations to come, our children and our children's children. to know the good things in life. This place. One cannot think.
And when did you write that?
Oh, I don't know, a long, long time ago. Yeah, it's all in bits and pieces. I just wrote, scribbled it down on paper. I don't know. I think after I'd been to Passchendaele, you know, when I'd returned there and from, you know, gone on holiday there. As a matter of fact, I think it was after I'd taken a young fella that was. I met him one night at the British Legion, and he said to me, he said, Albert, he said, I would like to return to Belgium and see. It was on, oh dear, nothing.